look at the very last little grouping there. Remember the title? I don't think I ever really got around. I said about six different things that are missing. I'm not sure it wasn't a clear statement per se, like the way teachers are supposed to do it. I'm always violating the rules. What is missing in our marriages? That last main point there, first step towards safe and trusting connection. The missing piece is the safe and trusting connection. There should be a qualifier there. Deeper safe and trusting connection. Because we all have a level of, that's why we're together. We have a level of safe and trusting connection. But for that to be growing and moving and getting deeper and safer, rather than those negative dance getting in play where it's actually less safe and less trusting. So what we were trying to think about is how do we see the dance that we dance that can be so distant? But we're missing really the needs of each other, the stuff of each other. Missing the music, hearing the music, the emotions, the questions that we have. Are you struggling with me? Oh, I did unmute it.
I just didn't have the power on.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I didn't mean to, you know, make it clear who's at fault here. Answering that alternate dance to a connection. I want to look at the Hold Me Tight pages, 124 through 129, which is going back a few pages from this. I had this idea this morning. I could have like written page numbers in this. It would have been a lot easier. So it looks like this. It starts with de-escalating disconnection. 124, this is both a way of reviewing, but maybe organizing a little bit. What we talked about last night. De-escalating disconnection. Now let's replay this little drama. She's been talking about a couple in video pages. Stopping the game. That's the first piece. Figuring out how is it that we get into a dance, into a game, into some sort of process where we're defending, we're attacking some pattern like that that tends to come up. In their argument, Claire and Peter were totally ensnared in attacking the event. Who's right? Who's wrong? Who's victim? Who's villain? Our antagonist using the pronouns I and you almost exclusively. I'm entitled to caring here. And if you can't step up and do that, then I can do without you. The victory is a little hollow, though, since this isn't what she wants. Peter quietly responds, can you stop this? Aren't we both defeated in this spiral? He's changed the pronoun to you. So he's stopping again. She changes her perspective and tone. Yes, she says, but this is the place we always go to. We get trapped here. We both want to prove our point, so we do that. We end up totally exhausted. Somewhere in the way distant past, some book on counseling couples talked about helping couples switch from away from using the pronoun you and make I statements. And that was in some popular books too. And it's very helpful. I mean, it's a really good idea. But it's so hard to do. I mean, just to get I'm not gonna say you anymore. I'm gonna say what's going on in me. So it works for about three words, you know. I hate it when you do that. I'm making an I statement now, right? And sometimes it's not that obvious. But the main reason it's so difficult is it wasn't paying attention to why do we do that. Why do we do that attacking stuff? Somewhere in this mass of pieces of paper, she talks about, Sue Johnson talks about, we're protesting against the disconnection. It's the only thing we know to do. We feel the disconnection, we don't like it, we're longing for more connection, but we don't know what to do, and we're not really thinking about it all that consciously. We're just feeling it, feeling the discomfort of it, and we're trying to counter that. And so we're blaming our spouse. You're the reason for this. I want to be connected. You're the reason for this. So shape up. Come join me. But that's too scary to actually be that straight and narrow. Because that, we don't like to show that we're vulnerable. And our whole world tells us, oh, don't let them see your fear. Don't do that. Don't be vulnerable. And we just, and it's true in some situations, it's not wise. But this is a relationship where we're trying to build connection. And you can't do that without opening your heart and showing that vulnerability. Stopping the game. Claiming your own moves. Being responsible for what you did and who you are and how you're approaching what you did. When I came to work at Covenant Seminary first in 1990, a man named Paul Koister was president of the seminary. You might be aware of that name. He left Covenant after about 9 or 10 years, and his mission to the world was in this terrible financial situation. And Paul's somebody who fixes organizations. It was time for him to leave Covenant in a certain sense because he had fixed it and he was kind of bored. And if you ever work with one of those kind of people, they tend to create problems on you to murder to fix them, have something to do. And, I for one was like, Paul, stay out of my stuff, because I don't know the stuff I got to fix after you stirred all this stuff up. He's a wonderful man, like, best man I've ever worked for in terms of boss. But something that Paul did very early, he did it all the time, in conversation with him, so he'd ask me a question, and I would start to, I think, answer his question. And repeatedly, he would just say, don't be defensive. And for a long time, I was like, inside, truth is, it was so natural for me. I'm a pretty rational person, so natural for me to explain myself, to keep myself looking good. Don't let anybody see what's real, if it's not all together. And gradually over time, Paul was a wonderful blessing in my life in that way, and helped me grow as a person, because he's just trying to get straight answers. And really just answers of, but what happened? And gradually learn, all this whole life works, but this job, my relationship with my the head boss, the president of the seminary, it just all works a whole lot better if I just say, hey, Paul, I messed up. He was okay with that. He knew people messed up. His next question was, okay, so what are you going to do? But it helped, it started a process really. So I'm 37 years old when I started that job, but I'm finally starting the process in a way that actually is going to go somewhere. Stop being defensive. Don't be defensive. It doesn't work in relationships. Then, after 5 years in that particular role at seminary, student services, switched over to teaching at the counseling department. That was a new department, new degree program started by first professor Richard Winter, still there, for a little while longer. And I became the second person. Richard's British, he's from England. And part of what that means is he's pretty direct. Also, Richard's father was a doctor. Richard's a psychiatrist, actually. He's not a counselor, lowly PhD like me. He's a psychiatrist and worked in the hospital for 7 years, and then in Francis Schaeffer's Marie organization, working in the Covenant. He doesn't understand it. I mean, he understands that it happens. He doesn't know why. He's amazingly intimidating. The counseling faculty do interviews with prospective students, and I hear the stories of the people that, you know, come and, you know, say, oh, I interviewed Dr. Martin. I got in my car and I just cried. I mean, it just has that impact. It was a test for me that, you know, one of those times where I messed up. It's part of the deal is Richard's running this thing, they hired me to do administration, like rendering, you know, helping with that. And so, you know, I'm responsible for a lot of stuff and mess up. It was a real test. So, really? Do I go and I say, Richard, I messed up? Really? I don't know if I can do that. But I learned.
That's just the best thing.
Richard and I are a lot of times. Just it's one of the most important, significant blessings in my life that I've been able to work in the same place, the same car, the same person for 20 years. Nobody gets that. And it's a feat. But it has a lot to do with both of us, really. We need to be humble. So a connection is happening. We never set out to do that. We just set out to figure out how to make this thing go. Keep it going. Connection. So it's that claiming your own moves. I went into all of that. It took probably too much time. Trying to undermine, believe me, I have all people. She can say that real easily. Come on, that is a real, real challenge. That goes against the grain of who we are as human beings. You're not very old. Some of you have your younger kids with you. Your son is 4, going to be 5 in 10, 14 days? 17 days. 24. Good to do that. He's way past this. He's already learned. There are places where I have to protect myself. Now, he doesn't know he's learned that. That's part of the problem. It's driven deep into the soul. You know? Just show your good side. Or when you're caught, figure a way to get out of it. Figure out how right now you could do, in this moment, your own version of Adam's, the woman you get. It's building all this. So this is not an easy thing, but she's exactly right. That's like, oh, this changes your relationship. And it doesn't have to be great, big, huge things. I mean, it's just I do my best thinking driving, and so that means sometimes when I go back home, it's like, you know, Caroline, this morning when you said this, and when I said that, when I left today, I realized, I don't think I even know what you meant. I reacted to it out of something. And I'm sorry, because I missed you. I missed it. So, can we go back to that? Can you clue me in? Because I missed it. Take responsibility. So that would be a big thing. Claire complained that Peter tuned her out. It will almost always feel like that. You weren't tuned in, or you tuned out. Pay attention to something else. Claiming your own feelings. Now we're getting harder. Because it's really hard to claim feelings that you don't even know about. A lot of times. We scream. There is a gender factor, especially us guys. It's harder, tougher to figure out what's going on. For most of us guys, and maybe work does this, but I think culture's done it, we're not sure it's even a good idea to like pay attention to feeling stuff. Because it's just mysterious, and it creates bad things. And, you know, it's like, really? Pay attention to know them so you can claim them. Owning how you shape your partner's feelings
Are you getting a feel for how different this is? Because in our typical disagreements, what we're doing is we're trying to get our spouse, trying to get our spouse to get how they're impacting us. And in doing that, we're ignoring how we're impacting them. Especially even in that moment. You know? It's like, no, but you need to see, you don't understand. When they've just said something to us in terms of what we need them to understand about them, what are you responding with? No, you're not understanding me. This is the antidote, but it's exactly opposite. And it does make it tough, because it is so different. Owning how you shape our experience. We need to recognize how our usual ways of dealing with our emotions pull our partner off balance and turn on deeper attachment.
Okay,
absolutely.
Okay. This will help me just think this through. So, you know, reading an example of where, you know, this fictional couple and trying to think through this, and I hear you saying that when we're disconnected or when we're in our cycle of being, that there's attachment fears and things. Is that generally going on? Because when I try to think of, you know, specific examples, I just think of like a specific thing you're angry about, a specific point you're trying to make. But you're saying there's feelings or attachment fears usually are always under the surface that we're not really facing.
The more I think about this, the more I read, the more I try to put the Bible and this thinking together, the more strongly I think it's always, for all of us.
And we're just not thinking about that, we're just thinking about
exactly. The
point, the moment, the argument.
We're not very conscious.
Okay, thank you.
Some of this will be historical, in terms of your family history, your relationship history, you know, that shapes you. Does it not in a deterministic way, because you are who you are when you came out of the womb. But we're also impacted by that environment, by that nurture or lack of it. So, and your default will be shaped by that. It's partly temperament, but it's also environment, and I don't know where one starts and the other stops, and which is more important. Probably varies depending on the person. But just a quick, for an example, quick picture. Just my personal story. So when I was 5 years old, my father died. That was 1958. These days that just seems like a long, 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 long time ago. I don't know why it didn't, like last year, it didn't seem like that long ago. So just culturally, so he was pastoring a Nazarene church, small church, Madison, Wisconsin, maybe 100 people. I don't know my father very well, but in trying to sort of figure out and discern, there have been some facts that I can look at and say, whoa, there was something unusual about my father. One of those was, it's 1958 when he died. We're talking about the middle 50s now. I think he moved there in 1950. So those 8 years he pastors this church. Not a very large church. There are people who are poor. There are people who are university professors. How does that happen? It doesn't usually happen like that. We usually get, you know, with people that were kind of similar. There were a couple of families that were Native American. There was one of the professors was Chinese. A different professor was Asian Indian. I can't remember if there was an African American family. Maybe not. Madison was pretty segregated at that time. And I'm forgetting something else. So, that's just strange to have this very diverse congregation in 1955 or since. Story-wise, it made sense. It came to make sense to me later because he was raised by his grandmother. Grandmother was an unusual character. There was a little snippet of story that whenever my great-grandmother came up,
My mom always had to say it. Well, you know, Grandma White was the first white woman in Pocatello County, Idaho. And she went there on a in a covered wagon. And before she died, she rode on a jet plane. You didn't say jet. If you can say the story. And eventually, putting those two facts together was like, oh, Grandma White was this wonderful character, this wonderful person who finds herself, she's the minority. And somehow she related to love. And she, my father was 2 years old when she got him and his one-year-old brother, and there also there were another one of her daughters that died young, and there were three boys, and she ends up raising these five boys. She always gets the credit. I don't know why Grandpa White doesn't get more credit for all that. And somehow she nurtured those kids. That's a pretty old woman. Nurtured those kids. And I don't know how old she was. I don't want to see pictures of she's very little white hair. When she died. And my father was the more nurturing parent. My mom's story is very different. Something like a Cinderella story, almost, and some emotional abuse from her father that damaged her. She was 96 when she died, 2 years before. And it's still affecting her as a 96-year-old. And she just didn't have the capacity, didn't know. She just couldn't nurture. So dad dies, brings three boys, I'm the youngest, and mom can't really step up. Dad had been the source of nurture. Fast forward. 3-4 years ago now, interviewing one of those prospective students, this was a wonderful, wonderful young woman about 25 years old. She became my most recent, favorite prospective student of all time. She didn't come. I'm very disappointed. She didn't come for circumstances. But as we're interviewing, she's sharing her story. Parents were missionaries in a Middle Eastern country. She was sexually abused, starting about 8 years old, as I remember. I think they returned to this country when she was like maybe 12. Then also sexually abused by someone in the family. She didn't tell me who that was, not for the country. Went into therapy. As a 13, 14, 15-year-old. As a 15-year-old, therapist says, we've done as much as we can, wise. She went on, super in school, super in college, graduates from college, ends up in Washington, D.C., working within the top organization in our country, probably the world, that works with sex trafficking. And she's listening to the stories of these women. She falls apart. Completely falls apart. Resigns, goes home, returns to the previous therapist. And the previous therapist helps her come to grips with the fact that the sexual abuse, like all of sin, shatters. But in her case, it actually shattered personally. So she's that what we commonly call multiple personality. Now, I've used the wrong term. It's dissociative identity disorder. Dissociating your identities, splitting them. Because she actually doesn't have the separate personalities. I didn't know that was, I was probably supposed to know that. I didn't know that was possible. And she explained it to me in a really nice sense and said, oh, that's kind of, it's hard because, we've seen the movies or something. And we only think of it one way. Remember, this is a wonderful person. This is one of my favorite people I've ever met. But she was explaining that she had to come to grips with the fact that her main defense, her go-to defense, is dissociation. As the therapist was helping her think about this, and she's resisting thinking about it and talking about it in her therapy, her therapist asks her a question. So, what do you feel in your feet right now? Remember, we're embodied souls. Where do you feel in your feet right now? And she honestly said, what feet? Just broken away from me. Associated. There's a lot of putting together in this gap. But she, this is something she's going to deal with her life. It's who she is. She's shaped. So she, with a wonderful smile and sort of a chuckle, said, yeah, I have to go home sometimes and we have to have a conversation. Meaning, just to talk with herself. To kind of reconnect stuff, keep it connected, and function that way. She just knows she's going to do that. And I'm sitting in a chair across from her, sort of entranced in this conversation. More than one thing at a time. I'm entranced and I'm really focused and connected to this conversation. But there's this whole other part of me that's going, oh my goodness, this is me. This is me. I've dissociated. That's how I survive. I've summarized it by saying, well, I mean, I tend to, you know, I'm laid back, or I tend to withdraw, or I might check out, but it's, you know, it's deeper. I've dissociated. And so many things became explainable. For a long time, I've known it was significant, but I couldn't put the significance to it in a certain kind of way until that moment. I remember a conversation. I'm 16 or 17. My boss was a school teacher who attended our church, and in the summers, he had a painting business. And he hired teenagers. He'd been the youth director. We had teenagers from the church to work for him. And my brother, one of my brothers had worked for him in the past. So I hired on. And I was one of the work. It was that first or second year, conversation with him. I know we were ending the job. I can actually see the house. He's down on his knees doing one of those last minute things that sometimes he didn't like doing. And I'm standing there waiting for him to get done because I have to move the ladder to take some drop cloths away or something like that. You know, the grunt work. And he's had this conversation and he says, whatever we were talking about, well, you know how your mother is. So I did the teenage grunt, probably nodded my head, even though he couldn't see me. Kind of a, yeah, I know how my mother is. But I'm thinking, I don't know how to do that. How do you know what a person's like? No, I don't know how my mother is. That was a product of the dissociation. That was the thing that I depended on. I needed connection, emotional connection with my mom, which didn't have any. But I couldn't consciously, you know, wrestle with that and figure out a way to, oh, you're looking at me like you just feel so sorry for me. I'm really okay. I really appreciate your good heart. I'm sorry to embarrass you about it. I needed that connection.
Yes.
And maybe I did that because I was human. But I didn't know how to do it, and it's a lot easier to do something, fight it, protest it. Or run away. And you can run away internally, and I'm really good at it. Well, God used that. I believe that interview with that prospective student who never came was for me. And it was only, it was 4 years ago. But in these 4 years, I was 58 at the time. Wow, kind of late in life to be figuring out what you need to do to grow up. Yeah. That'd give you a lot of hope, right? And it's amazing how much it's changed and how other factors fit in. So now I'm teaching a class. I'm in there in the room. I only have an hour of it. Responsibility. He has 3 credit hours. Mike Williams, one of our theologians, and part of what he's talking about for several class sessions is being image bearers.
So, you know, for three semesters now, I've been hearing this. I mean, I knew the stuff, but, it, you know, it's... Repetition is really the point of learning. I mean, you just hear it over and over and over, it goes deeper. And all of that, and it's like... So, because of that, thing God's doing about battling the dissociation, and trying to reconnect myself. By the way, so many of the things that I've been convinced really couldn't change in my marriage until Caroline changed. You know, even though I know better, I hit deeper down, it's like, still, come on. I'm aware now that moving toward being connected scares me. Daylights out of me. It's what I need. It's what a person needs. But, you know, when you found another way, it kind of like the other way. Because you've done that for safety's sake. Now, it's not the best safety. It's not the safety we really need, the safety within a good, strong connection and that trusting safety. It's an isolated safety. And it's like, wow, if she did not make some of those changes that I think I wanted her to make, I wouldn't be happy. Because it would require something from me. I'd have to actually move toward her. It's kind of been, could have had a V8, it's really been me all along.
So that's very similar to the story that you were telling about the couple, I think, yesterday, with respect to the moment that the pastor acquiesced and was like, no, now I'm looking forward to going. Well, at that point, the wife, you know, in order to remain basically separated, has to change her tack in order to maintain the separation. So she says, no, I'm not going anymore. Because otherwise, then there's a movement together that begins at that point.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And we have this, we do this. And it's terrible. It really is. It's awful. I mean, we were just talking about this morning. For a while, last night, frankly, when you were talking about the physical manifestations, I was like, what are you talking about? You know? And then I started to think about what it is that you're talking about were indicators. You know, about being aware of your emotional or physical indicators of when you get into the cycle, or where that cycle begins. And we were talking about stuff like from the very beginning of our marriage last night. We were like, and I was like, you know, we carry those issues and arguments with us into every single moment that we. Where we are arguing or at odds, or you know, where we are separate, we are escaping, running away from that stuff. Now, I mean, we are still doing it. At least I was saying that. I mean, and even that, I mean, that's what you're saying. I mean, you sort of train yourself to. Protect yourself in those ways, and you know the thing is that you recognize that you're doing, but you also recognize that God, you know, the gospel has a presence in this. You know that the work of Christ in you says, yeah, but you know, love, but always go back to love. You know, I mean, and I was like, you know, I recognize the reason why I do these things, you know, but I also recognize that what I should be doing is instead of reacting, I should be seeking away from love. You know, like the dishwasher thing. I love that example because it's so simple, right?
Yeah.
And the thing about the dishwasher thing is, yeah, so it makes sense to wait until it's full, but this would be meaningful to you. So because it's meaningful to you, I'm going to push the button myself.
You know, nice.
But it's hard to get past your own issue to the point where you're seeking to love the other more than react to your own issues. But in order to be able to do that, you have to know that you're having the issues. You know, and so that's the I think the good part about the indicator. I wish that there was a physical indicator like my ear. ear fell off. Well, something obvious I could possibly say it than that. I'm way too likely to go slow like possible.
Maybe that's what happened.
My answer is perfect.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But there probably are other indicators, but in the midst of it, it's so hard to see it. You know, it would be great maybe if she knew what my indicators were, so she could say, no, before you say anything, I can tell by the look on your face that you're in this place. It's probably best if you just take a minute.
And you're going to listen.
It's possible. I don't know. We never tried that.
Well, I think that's what's stopping the games. Claire declares, I'm entitled to caring here. If you can't step up and do that, then I can do without you. Peter quietly responds, let me stop this.
I mean, I think it's the same thing. It's what it takes. And you're giving us a really good feel for how courageous you have to be to actually step up and say, here we go again. Or you can use a break. or whatever.
And it also takes courage to follow the lead. I feel like it's like if
yes.
your partner starts going there, but you still want to hold on to what you have, like that break of